Good afternoon. This is Bill Copeland. Today we're going to talk about the Federal False Claims Act, particularly enforcement and recent updates. My objective for the program today. My objectives for the program today are to provide an understanding of the False Claims Act, its various elements, how it works, and its whistleblower provisions. I also want to provide an understanding of the federal enforcement efforts and to show how an action is filed, how the government responds, and how the courts interpret the False Claims Act. I want to show how the False Claims Act is being used in the healthcare arena and provide an understanding of how the False Claims Act has been impacted by the Affordable Care Act. So let's get started. The Federal False Claims Act is a federal statute that prohibits, among other things, anyone from presenting a false or fraudulent claim for payment to the federal government. It also prohibits causing the use of a false record to get a claim paid by the federal government. Now, in the healthcare context, this would include billing for work not performed, upcoding, billing for unnecessary services, and even billing for services that were obtained in violation of other regulations, such as the anti-kickback and the STARK anti-referral law. The bottom line, the False Claims Act covers fraud against the federal government. Now, the original act was passed in 1863 under President Lincoln. Basically, to combat fraud by war profiteers. Munitions were being delivered to the battlefield that contained nothing. When they were open, it contained nothing but sawdust, and Lincoln felt something must be done and convinced Congress to pass the False Claims Act. Now, the act was amended in 1986 to encourage its use as a weapon against fraud. And the number of cases filed by whistleblowers since the 1986 amendments has risen from 33 in 1987 to over 700 in 2020. Now, from 1986 to 2020, the federal government recovered more than $64 billion, with a B, under the False Claims Act. More than two-thirds of this was recovered in cases filed by whistleblowers under the KTAM provisions of the False Claims Act. KTAM is a shortened version for a long Latin term that means he who files an action for himself as well as for the king. Now, these brave individuals took significant risks to provide this information to the government. Fortunately, the False Claims Act rewards doing the right thing, and since 1986, whistleblowers have received over $7.8 billion under the False Claims Act. In 2020 alone, whistleblowers helped recover approximately $2.2 billion and were awarded over $309 million. The number of False Claims Act filings hits a record. Healthcare continues to dominate the False Claims Act recoveries, with kickbacks a major focus. Through the end of fiscal year 2020, ending September 30th, 2020, total recoveries across all years under the False Claims Act have eclipsed $64 billion, with over $7.8 billion awarded to relators for their whistleblowing efforts. Whistleblowers' lawsuits gave rise to approximately $1.8 billion of the total $2.2 billion in annual recoveries. And over 80% of the total annual recoveries. And like in prior years, whistleblowers were richly rewarded for their efforts, with over $3.9 billion awarded to whistleblowers in 2020. How does this work? The False Claims Act provides a financial incentive for people with knowledge of false claims against the federal government to come forward. It does so by rewarding a successful relator, which is the plaintiff in a False Claims Act case, with between 15 and 30% of any recovery from a defendant. The relator files a False Claims Act suit. As I said, this is also called a KTAM suit, on behalf of the United States. It's filed under seal, therefore it's not a public record, along with a disclosure statement providing evidence to the government. Now, while under seal, the government investigates the allegations and decides whether to intervene. And during this period, the defendant may not even be aware of the case. If the government intervenes, the government becomes the primary prosecutor, although the relator still has some input, and the relators receive between 15 and 25% of any recovery. If the government does not intervene, the relator can still go forward with the suit, and if successful, receives between 25 and 30% of any recovery. To prove a False Claims Act violation, the relator must show that the defendant was responsible for the false claim to the federal government. The relator initially presents the evidence in a disclosure statement, as I stated before, submitted to the government at the time the complaint is filed. This disclosure statement sets forth all the evidence that the relator possesses regarding the false claim, and it generally points the government to additional persons or documents that would substantiate the allegations. The evidence provided needs to be as detailed as possible. It's not sufficient to base a complaint on rumors of wrongdoing. There should be specific allegations showing the time, date, place, and content of any false claim. It's also very helpful to have documentation supporting the allegations. The false claim must be shown by the civil standard, preponderance of the evidence, meaning more likely than not. It does not have to be shown by the criminal standard, beyond a reasonable doubt. The relator does not have to show specific intent to defraud. The statute defines knowingly to include acting with deliberate ignorance or reckless disregard of the truth or falsity of the information. Now, the 1986 amendments to the False Claims Act clarified and relaxed these burdens of proof, in part to prevent the ostrich or head in the sand offense. For example, a physician signing off on a HCPA 1500 form would find it difficult to defend a False Claims Act violation by claiming that he knew nothing of the billing practice and left it all to his staff. Now, anyone with knowledge of the illegal conduct can bring a False Claims Act suit. However, this is usually a current or former employee of the defendant. However, if the relator planned and initiated the False Claims Act violation, the reward to the relator may be reduced, and if the relator is criminally convicted for his or her role, the relator must be dismissed from the suit. There are limits on bringing a False Claims Act suit. You must bring the case within 6 years of the date of the false claim, or within 3 years after the government knows or should have known of the false claim, but no event. Then you bring the action later than 10 years after the false claim. In addition, if the allegations in the False Claims Act suit were already publicly disclosed, the relator has to be the original source of the allegations who brought the information to the government before filing the action. One cannot bring a False Claims Act suit for the allegations are already the subject of a civil suit or administrative civil penalty proceeding where the government is a party. However, under Obamacare, the criteria has changed. The public disclosure jurisdictional bar has substantially changed. It now allows KTAM suits, even where the allegations are publicly disclosed and the relator does not possess independent knowledge of the allegations. In addition, because the public disclosure bar is no longer a jurisdictional bar, the dismissal of a KTAM suit on the basis of public disclosure can be opposed by the Department of Justice. Public disclosure is now limited to federal proceedings, public news, and social media. State proceedings and private litigation are now not considered public disclosure. Before Obamacare, the relator needed to have direct and independent knowledge of the allegations. Now the direct knowledge requirement has been eliminated. To qualify as original source, the relator must voluntarily provide information on the claim or transaction to the government before public disclosure, or the information must be independent of and materially add to the publicly disclosed information. Now, the pleading requirements under the False Claims Act generally require that four elements be established. One, that there is a false statement or a fraudulent course of conduct that was made or carried out with the knowledge sufficient to charge the person with the consequences of his or her acts. Scienter. That it was material, and this is very important, that it caused the government to pay out money. In other words, it involved a claim. If the government would have paid the claim, even if it knew it was false, then it's not a false claim within the meaning of the False Claims Act. In other words, to qualify, it must be a condition of payment. Now, this fourth element has also changed. In Escobar, the Supreme Court, in the decision by Justice Thomas, writing for an 8-0 majority, stated, quote, the implied false certification theory can be a basis of liability. Specifically, liability can attach when the defendant submits a claim for payment that makes specific representations about the goods or services provided, but knowingly fails to disclose the defendant's noncompliance with a statutory, regulatory, or contractual requirement. In these circumstances, liability may attach if the omission renders these representations misleading. Justice Thomas goes on that the implied certification can be the basis of liability, at least where two conditions are satisfied. First, the claim does not merely request payment, but also makes specific representations about the goods or services provided. And second, if the defendant's failure to disclose noncompliance with material, statutory, regulatory, or contractual requirements makes those representations misleading, half-truth. Addressing the second of these three principles, the court rejected the argument that liability attaches only when the undisclosed noncompliance with the provision is expressly designed as a condition of payment. That designation is relevant, but not dispositive. Rather, the test is one of materiality, the court said. How is materiality determined? Justice Thomas, citing Wilson on contracts, stated that under any understanding of the concept, materiality looks to the effect on the likely or actual behavior of the recipient of the alleged misrepresentation. He then cited the definitions in both the restatement of torts and the restatement of contracts to define the circumstances when a misrepresentation is material. Eight, when it would affect the decision of a reasonable man, and B, when the defendant knows or should know that it would affect the decision of a particular recipient. Now, while the complaint does not need detailed factual allegations, the plaintiff's obligation to provide the grounds of his entitlement to relief requires more than labels and conclusions, and a formalistic recitation of the elements of the cause of action will not do. The factual allegations must be enough to rise to the right of relief above the speculative level, on the assumption that all of the allegations in the complaint are true, even if some are doubtful in fact. If the complaint does not contain enough facts to make the claim plausible on its face, it will probably be dismissed. A claim is plausible on its face if the complaint contains sufficient facts for the court to draw an inference that the defendant is liable for the alleged conduct. Federal Rule of Civil Procedure Rule 9B requires a heightened level of specificity when pleading fraud. It states, in part, that in all affirmance of fraud or mistake, the circumstances constituting the fraud or mistake shall be stated with particularity. Federal courts have analogized fraud pleading to the first paragraph in a newspaper story, regarding the who, what, when, where, and how of the circumstances. Note the decision in Medtronic, where the court dismissed the Relator's False Claims Act claim against the device manufacturer because a complaint failed to meet the heightened pleading standard of Rule 9B. The court noted that the complaint failed to adequately allege the who, what, when, where, and whether the claim to the federal program was submitted for payment. With regard to the requirements of 9B, the Foss case, which was a Eastern District of Pennsylvania case, states, the relator must plead the following elements with particularity. One, a specific false representation of a material fact. Two, knowledge by the person who made it of his falsity. Three, ignorance of his falsity by the government. Four, the intention that it should be acted upon. And fifth, that the government acted upon it to its damage. Stated another way, the elements of a fraud case action are the following. A representation, usually a fact, which is false. Knowledge that it's false. The intent of the fraud, justifiable reliance on the misrepresentation, and damage resulting from the justifiable reliance. Now, the damages under the False Claims Act are as follows. In addition to treble damages, costs, attorney's fees, and penalties, the Department of Justice increased the false claim penalty range from a minimum of $5,500 to a maximum of $11,000 per false claim. Filing the suit is not without risk, however. Once the government decides whether to intervene, the case is unsealed. At that point, service of the complaint is made on the defendant, and the defendant knows the identity of the relator. This may lead to retaliation by a defendant. However, a section of the False Claims Act provides strong protection for whistleblowers. Whether or not the relator proves the underlying False Claims Act violation, this provision provides significant protection to the relator. In addition, If the defendant prevails in the suit, the court finds the suit was clearly frivolous, vexatious, or brought for harassment, then the court may find the relator liable for the defendant's expenses and fees. Healthcare fraud has become one of the primary targets of False Claims Act suits. Not only has the number of cases risen dramatically since 1986, but also there is a distinct trend toward healthcare fraud cases. In 1994, only 18% of the cases involved healthcare fraud. Of the current cases, in excess of 80% involve healthcare fraud. The typical case proceeds as follows. The whistleblower gathers the evidence, organizes it, analyzes it, and summarizes the case. Once the evidence is gathered, the whistleblower should find an attorney with False Claims Act experience. The attorney will then draft a complaint and put together a disclosure statement detailing the evidence. This disclosure statement is filed with the Department of Justice. At the same time, the complaint is filed under seal. Technically, the Justice Department is theoretically required to conduct its investigation within 60 days, during which time the case is under seal. Routinely, at the end of this initial 60-day period, the government asks for a 6-month extension. A 6-month extension of the seal in order to continue its investigation. The government's decision to intervene or to decline intervention within the suit may be made at the end of the first 60-day period, or the seal may be renewed several times. On average, these cases take 38 months to resolve. However, some take a decade or longer. Sometimes the government may ask to have the seal partially lifted in order to negotiate a settlement. It is not unusual for a case to remain under seal for 2 years or longer, during which time agents of the FBI and any number of other federal agencies may execute subpoenas, issue search warrants, interview witnesses, and review documents in order to get a better understanding of the whistleblowers.
Esquire CLE's first verification code is DOW, D-O-W, all lowercase, DOW. Please take a moment and write this down. Esquire CLE's first verification code is DOW, D-O-W, all lowercase, DOW. Please take a moment and write this down.
Fraud allegations. During this investigation period, the whistleblower is usually asked penetrating questions. If the government decides to intervene, the whistleblower can pursue the case on his or her own or decide to drop the case at that time. Pursuing the case on his or her own involves a higher risk, but it also has higher potential rewards. According to a report from the Department of Health and Human Services and the Department of Justice, in fiscal year 2020, the Department of Justice opened 1,148 new criminal healthcare fraud investigations. Federal prosecutors filed criminal charges in 412 cases involving 679 defendants. A total of 440 defendants were convicted of healthcare fraud related crimes during the year. Also, in fiscal year 2020, DOJ opened 1,179 new civil fraud investigations and had 1,498 civil fraud matters pending at the end of the fiscal year. In fiscal year 2020, investigations conducted by the HHS Office of the Inspector General, the OIG, resulted in 578 criminal actions against individuals or entities that engaged in crimes related to Medicare or Medicaid, 781 civil actions, which include false claims and unjust enrichment lawsuits filed in federal district court, civil monetary penalty settlements, and administrative recoveries relating to provider self-disclosure matters. The HHS-OIG also excluded 2,148 individuals and entities from participation in Medicare, Medicaid, and other federal health care programs. Enforcement activities include the Strike Force, the Healthcare Fraud Strike Force team. This is a program that is comprised of interagency teams where investigators and prosecutors focus on the worst offenders and reasons where there is a known concentration of fraudulent activities. Using advanced data analysis techniques, the Strike Force identifies aberrant billing levels in healthcare fraud hotspots. Cities with higher billing level, higher levels of billing fraud, to target suspicious billing practices. The teams also identify emerging schemes and schemes that migrate from one community to another. Since its inception, Strike Force prosecutors file more than 2,100 cases, charging more than 4,600 defendants who collectively bill federal health care programs and private insurers approximately $23 billion. Of these cases, more than 3,000 defendants pleaded guilty, and over 390 were convicted in jury trials. And more than 2,800 defendants were sentenced to imprisonment for an average term of approximately 50 months. The Open Fraud and Abuse Detection Unit. This unit is an activity in the Department of Justice Criminal Division that uses data from various healthcare fraud databases to identify medical practitioners who are contributing to the prescription opioid epidemic. A related effort focused solely on investigating and prosecuting offenses by healthcare providers who engage in fraudulent activity related to prescription opioids. This includes pill mill schemes and pharmacists that dispense prescription opioids for illegitimate purposes. The unit works with the FBI, the DEA, HHS, and local and state partners. The objective is to target and prosecute doctors, pharmacists, medical providers who are contributing to the opioid epidemic. The Healthcare Fraud Prevention and Enforcement Team, also known as HEAT. HEAT is charged with gathering resources across government, cracking down on fraud and abuse, reducing healthcare costs and improving quality, highlighting best practices, and building on existing partnership between the Department of Health and Human Services and the Department of Justice. The Healthcare Fraud Prevention Partnership. This is a voluntary public-private partnership consisting of the federal government, state agencies, law enforcement, private health insurance plans, employer organizations, and healthcare anti-fraud associations. Its purpose is to exchange data and information between the partners. This helps to enhance the ability to fight fraud, waste, and abuse in the healthcare industry. The Fair Labor Practice Associates versus Quest Diagnostics is a case that deals with attorney ethical obligations. The complaint in this case alleged that the defendant laboratory charged Medicare and Medicaid to subsidize discounts to private insurers. Before leaving the company, The general counsel and three of the defendant's executives questioned the legality of this practice. After they left the company, they formed a partnership and filed a KTAM suit under the False Claims Act. In prosecuting the suit, the former general counsel allegedly revealed confidential information in pleadings and in deposition testimony. The defendant moved to dismiss, arguing that the general counsel violated obligations. Specifically, the defendant alleged that the general counsel, quote, used confidential information of a former client to the disadvantage of the former client without reasonably believing its use to be necessary to prevent the client from committing a crime, end quote. The court found for the defendants and dismissed the case. The court said, quote, there is a long-standing tradition of clients being able to communicate freely with their counsel without fearing that their confidential communications may become the basis of a later suit. Otherwise, companies may have been discouraged from seeking legal advice about False Claims Act compliance, end quote. Let's review some recent enforcement cases that are representative of the focus of this enforcement. Harden House. According to the court, relators Joyce Hildred, Sean Williams, and Carlos Scott and Andrea Wilson were each employed in different capacities by the defendants, Harden House, and Drexel Consulting Services. Defendant Kathy Harden owns both Harden House and Drexel. Harden House and Drexel staff include counselors and therapists that provide inpatient and outpatient mental health and substance abuse services. Both Harden House and Drexel purport to determine their clients' unique needs. Purport to determine their clients a unique need, and they test every client for many different substances. For example, a client comes in seeking treatment for alcoholism is tested for drugs that are normally injected, as well as other drugs. When submitting their invoices, defendants, all of them, according to the Second Amended Complaint, intentionally and knowingly certified that the drug analysis were reasonable and necessary. In accordance with Federal Rule 9B, relators in False Claims Act cases must allege that the defendant made a statement in order to receive money from the government, that the statement was false, and that the government knew the statement was false. According to the court, looking only at the face of the second amended complaint, relators' claims do not include sufficient specificity to satisfy Rule 9B. With regard to Kathy Harden, the second amended complaint makes no mention of her involvement beyond the allegation that she owns some of the entities at issue. The second amended complaint does not allege any specific fraud circumstances that make it plausible that Mrs. Harden knew about, directed the implementation of the policies at issue here. The court said the False Claims Act against Mrs. Harden and the claim that Mrs. Harden conspired to violate the false miss. The court goes on, the claims against Harden House and Drexel fail as well. With regard to when the alleged fraud took place, the second amended complaint only narrows the window to a 9-year period, reaching back to at least 2011. It fails to identify any particular person that may have submitted false or fraudulent claims. It even fails to nail down the location where the statements were made, end quote. Gibson. This is a very interesting case. Defendant Ernest Gibson III was president of Riverside General Hospital in Houston, Texas. On June 9, 2015, Gibson III was given a 45-year prison sentence in order to pay restitution of almost $47 million for his role in a $158 million Medicare fraudulent anti-kickback scheme. Gibson's son and co-defendant, Gibson IV, received a 20-year sentence and was ordered to pay restitution of $7.5 million, while a co-conspirator received a 12-year prison term and a restitution order for $46.25 million. The Fifth Circuit found, quote, according to the government's cooperating witnesses, the appellants, Gibson III, his son Gibson IV, participated in three activities, one to defraud Medicare, another to pay unlawful kickbacks, and a third to launder money. A jury convicted the Gibsons of each of these allegations, plus several substantive kickback counts. The court goes on, quote, the evidence against Gibson III was similarly powerful. One supervisor explained that he and Gibson III entered into two contracts, one to pay the supervisor a percentage of Riverside's Medicare return, and another to pay him $16,000 a month for each month he referred between 26 and 30 Medicare patients to Riverside. The supervisor further admitted to paying marketers to meet his patient quota. What's more, he testified that Gibson III tracked those marketers' locations with a spreadsheet. According to the supervisor, Gibson III also talked about the census, the number of billable patients, all of the time. The instructions were to keep the census up, else Gibson III would terminate their contract. And this was no idle threat. The boss sent several letters to the supervisor to bring in more patients to increase Riverside's market share. Hebrew Homes. Hebrew Homes Health Network and William Zubkoff, its former president and executive director, have agreed to pay $17 million to resolve False Claims Act violations related to improperly paying physicians for referral of Medicare patients. According to the Department of Justice, from 2006 through 2013, Hebrew Homes allegedly operated a sophisticated kickback scheme in which they hired numerous physicians ostensibly as medical directors pursuant to contracts that specified numerous job duties and hourly requirements. The various facilities had several such medical directors under contract at any given time, paying each several thousand dollars monthly. The United States government alleged that in reality, these were ghost physicians and that most of the medical directors were required to perform few, if any, of their contracted job duties. Instead, they were allegedly paid for their patient referrals to the Hebrew Homes facilities, which increased exponentially once the medical directors were put on the payroll. Boston Heart. Labrador Boston Heart Diagnostic Corporation, or Boston Heart, of Framingham, Massachusetts, has agreed to pay $26.67 million to resolve False Claims Act allegations involving payments for patient referrals in violation of the anti-kickback statute and false Stark law for claims otherwise improperly billed to the federal government healthcare programs for laboratory testing. The settlement resolves allegations that Boston Heart provided physician practices with in-office dietitians in exchange for physician referrals for laboratory testing. These allegations were originally made in a case filed in the Eastern District of California under the whistleblower or KTAM provisions of the False Claims Act. In addition, the settlement resolves allegations that Boston Heart conspired with others to pay doctors kickbacks disguised as investment returns and conspired with several Texas hospitals and others to submit claims for outpatient laboratory testing for patients who were not hospital outpatients in order to receive higher reimbursements from the federal healthcare programs. The whistleblowers in this case will receive approximately $6.36 million of the settlement. There were two cases involved in this settlement. $4.36 million is a pretty good incentive to bring a whistleblower case. United States v. Patel. Dr. Mehmood Patel was convicted of 51 counts of billing for unnecessary procedures and was sentenced to 10 years in prison. He inserted hundreds of stents per year and had an annual income of $6 million plus. According to the DOJ, testimony at trial revealed that Dr. Patel, who was practicing interventional cardiology in Lafayette, Louisiana, and surrounding areas for more than 25 years, was falsifying the patient's symptoms and medical records, falsifying findings on medical tests, and performing unnecessary coronary procedures such as deploying angioplasty balloons and stents. Testimony from experts and cardiology specialties revealed that the defendant deployed stents, balloons, and radiation in coronary arteries that had little or insignificant disease. Sandeep Patel. Dr. Sandeep Patel of London, Kentucky, was sentenced to 30 months in federal prison. Dr. Patel pleaded guilty to submit.
Esquire CLE's second verification code is JET, J-E-T, all lowercase, JET. Please take a moment and write this down. Esquire CLE's second verification code is JET, J-E-T, all lowercase, JET. Please take a moment and write this down.
Improper bills to the Medicare program for cardiac angioplasty at St. Joseph London Hospital. For a cardiac stent procedure to qualify as medical necessity, it is generally accepted that a patient must have at least 70% blockage of an artery and symptoms of the blockage. Patel admitted that he placed stents in arteries that had substantially less than 70% blockage. Patel nonetheless recorded blockage of 70% or more in Medicare and patient documents to guarantee payment from Medicare and Medicaid. St. Joseph Health System in Louisville agreed to pay $16.5 million to settle a False Claims Act suit claiming that it paid doctors in London, Kentucky to refer patients to St. Joseph Hospital for unnecessary heart surgeries and procedures. Greenspan. Over 7 years, Dr. Greenspan referred more than 100,000 blood tests to Biodiagnostic Laboratory, which made more than $3 million off these tests. In exchange, The lab gave Greenspan and his associates more than $200,000 in cash, gifts, and other benefits. A jury convicted Greenspan of accepting kickbacks, using interstate facilities with the intent to commit personal commercial bribery, honest services wire fraud, and conspiracy to do all of these things. The Third Circuit confirmed, characterizing the evidence of his guilt as overwhelming. Thomas Whitten. According to the press release for the U.S. Attorney for the Western District of Pennsylvania, Dr. Whitten was indicted by a federal grand jury on February 2, 2020, on charges of conspiracy to violate the anti-kickback statute, conspiracy to distribute fentanyl, healthcare fraud, and conspiracy to distribute other controlled substances. According to the indictment, from May 2013 to November 2015, Whitten conspired to receive kickbacks from Ennis Therapeutics in exchange for prescribing Ennis brand of fentanyl substance to his patients, and that he conspired to distribute substance. The indictment also alleges that from May 2013 to 2017, Whitten committed health care fraud by causing insurers to pay for unlawful substance prescriptions. Frank Santangelo. Dr. Santangelo was sentenced to 63 months in prison for accepting $1.8 million in bribes to refer millions of dollars in business to Biodiagnostic Laboratory Services, BLS. In an information filed in the case, the information states, quote, in or about February 2013, co-conspirator David Nickel engaged in additional text message discussions with Frank Santangelo regarding the amount of money that defendant BLS, through co-conspirator David Nickel, was paying Frank Santangelo, using checks totaling more than $50,000 per month from defendant BLS to a female companion of Frank Santangelo to refer and increase patient blood testing volume. In one text message, Frank Santangelo stated, quote, my goal is for you to bill out more than $1 million a month. It's very possible, end quote. In another text message discussion, Santangelo stated, quote, me and another physician put our heads together and added a significant amount of testing. The testing is 90% legit. Also added two more endocrine panels. End quote. In another text message discussion, co-conspirator David Nickel and Frank Santangelo discussed the volume of referrals from Frank Santangelo's office to defendant BLS for the first 11 days in February of 2013. Nickel stated, quote, seven blood samples yesterday was great, but 11 for the rest of the month is weak. Seeing 20 people a day, you should get 40 easily. And that's only 10 a week, end quote. Community Health Network. On June 30th, 2020, Community Health Network agreed to pay more than $20.3 million to settle allegations that it submitted false claims to Medicare and Medicaid representing that certain outpatient surgical services were provided to patients at the hospital's outpatient departments, when in fact, they were performed at freestanding ambulatory surgery centers. Medicare pays more for procedures performed in the hospital outpatient department than for procedures performed at freestanding ambulatory surgery centers. Enzor Medical Sylvia Walter Easy, who formerly owned Enzor Medical Supply, was sentenced to 97 months in prison for her role in a $3.5 million scheme to defraud Medicare and California's Medi-Cal program by submitting claims for medically unnecessary durable medical equipment. The evidence at trial demonstrated that Walter Easy, the then owner of Enzor Medical Supply, paid illegal kickbacks to patient recruiters in exchange for patient referrals. The evidence further showed that Walter Easy paid kickbacks to physicians for fraudulent prescriptions, primarily for medically unnecessary but very expensive power wheelchairs that she then used to support her fraudulent bills to Medicare and Medi-Cal. Between 2007 and 2012, Walter Easy submitted over $3.5 million in claims to Medicare and Medi-Cal and received almost $2 million in reimbursement for those claims. Fuentes. Gladys Fuentes and her husband and business partner, Mario Fuentes, were sentenced to prison terms of 19 years and 6 months and 11 years and 3 months, respectively, for operating a sham clinic with their co-conspirators that recruited Medicare beneficiaries to enroll in Universal's Medicare Part C and Part D plans, and then billed for expensive treatments that were never actually performed. According to the evidence presented at trial, Gladys and Mario established and operated a sham clinic, Gables Medical and Therapy Center, for the purpose of committing healthcare fraud. They employed unlicensed medical professionals, misused the Medicare billing numbers of other medical professionals without their knowledge, in order to claim that they had rendered medical treatment to Gables patients. Gladys and Mario also paid a co-conspirator to recruit Medicare beneficiaries for Gables and to drive patients to the clinic for basic and sham medical services. Once recruited, Gladys and Mario urged the Gables patients to enroll in Universal's Medicare Part B and Part D plans. They believe that Universal paid a relatively high percentage of its claims. They then fraudulently billed Universal and caused Universal's Part C and plan to be billed for Cable's patients' supposed treatments. The treatments included expensive HIV-related treatments that patients never actually received. Gladys and Mario also billed Universal and caused Universal to be billed for services that required a physician's presence when no licensed physician had been present or had rendered the service. They billed Universal in excess of $900,000. Gladys and Mario and their co-conspirators paid the Medicare beneficiaries, who were recruited to come to Gables for their Medicare identification numbers to allow Gables to bill Universal for services that were never actually rendered. In addition, Gladys and Marielle facilitated the provision of fraudulent prescriptions for controlled substances, including oxycodone, to Gables patients. In some cases, the signatures on the prescriptions were forged. The patients who received these oxycodone prescriptions were assisted in filling them by a co-conspirator. The co-conspirator then purchased the pills from some of the patients and sold them on the street. These prescriptions were paid for as part of the beneficiary's Medicare Part D benefits. This was a case that was investigated by Heath. And this William Kelly Inc. and Omega Imaging Inc. together operate 11 radiology facilities in Southern California. The defendants have agreed to pay $5 million to resolve allegations that they violated the False Claims Act by knowingly submitting claims to Medicare and to TRICARE for unsupervised radiology services and for services provided at unaccredited facilities. The settlement resolves allegations that the defendants submitted claims for CT scans and for MRIs involving contrast injections that were not properly supervised by a physician. The settlement also resolves allegations that the certain number of defendants' facilities lack accreditation. Athena Health. According to the DOJ, Athena Health, a developer of electronic medical record services, agreed to pay $18.5 million to resolve allegations that it violated the False Claims Act by paying illegal kickbacks to generate sales of its electronic medical records product. In its complaint, the government alleged that Athena violated the False Claims Act and the anti-kickback statute through its marketing programs. First, Athena allegedly invited prospects and customers to all-expense-paid sporting, entertainment, and recreation benefits events. The most lavish of these events, such as bucket list trips to the Masters Tournament and the Kentucky Derby, included complimentary travel along with luxury accommodations, meals, and alcohol. In addition, Athena paid fees to customers through its lead generation program designed to identify new prospective customers. Under this program, Athena paid the client up to $3,000 per physician that the client signed up for Athena services, regardless of how much time the client spent speaking or meeting with the physician. Finally, the government alleged that Athena entered into deals with competing companies to discontinue their health information technology products. And as part of this deal, known as conversion deals, the other companies agreed to refer their clients to Athena and were paid based on the value and volume of physician practices that were successfully converted to Athena customers. Finally, we have the John Davis case. John Davis of Franklin, Tennessee, and the former chief executive officer of Anesthesia Services Associates, doing business as Comprehensive Pain Specialist, agreed to a permanent voluntary exclusion from participation in federal procurement and non-procurement programs. As part of the settlement, Davis agreed not to be employed in any industry or field in which he could, either directly or indirectly, submit claims seeking reimbursement from Medicare and other federal health care programs. In April 2019, Davis was convicted for his role in a $4 million Medicare and Medicare kickback scheme. In July 2020, Davis was sentenced on criminal charges to 42 months in prison. Now, before leaving office, then-President Donald Trump commuted Davis' sentence. So what does all of this bring us down to? What recommendations should we have? Well, you should advise your clients to develop a good compliance program that's a living document. What do I mean by a living document? It means don't put together a program and then put it on a shelf to gather dust. It should be a living, breathing document that's supported by top management. You should get the, you should advise your clients to get the concurrence of the Board of Trustees, make a proposal to the Board of Trustees so that you get their support. Should periodically conduct internal audits of billing and payment practices. You should review all contracts with physicians and other providers, paying very close attention to contracts with entities in a position to refer. Develop a good training program to teach compliance to employees and contracted personnel. Understand and comply with law and regulations. This is a very complex area of the law, and the client needs to have good advice from someone who practices in this area and understands its idiosyncrasies. Help them develop a culture of compliance. As again, as I said, strongly supported by top management, particularly the Board of Trustees. And above all, maintain quality of care. It's very important that the client maintains quality of care. Thank you very much for your attention. I hope it was informative. And that concludes the presentation.